Welcome, everyone, to the Goldster podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all characters and styles and their enriching stories about their lives, their victories, their failures, their dreams, and, of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the duration, and today we're exploring writing fiction. Please enjoy, and to find out more, check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. And without further ado, let us begin. Hello and welcome. I am Humphrey Hawksley, and this is Goldster Inside Story. And welcome to our podcast, listeners who will be tuning in sometime in the future to listen to our fabulous discussion that is going to take in climate change, the Caribbean, mermaids, magical islands, love, and creative writing, because my fantastic guest today is on the front line of all those issues and has one of the most vivid and disciplined imaginations of any author I have interviewed. Oh. You have to create a mythical love story between a fisherman and a mermaid with compelling credibility, and then go on to win the Costa Book of the Year Prize Award for your writing. Now, my guest was born in the Port of Spain in Trinidad. She teaches creative writing there and in Manchester, and is a leading literary voice on climate change, those battles to persuade government, corporations, and people to do the right thing. She is a founder of Writers Rebel. How much can authors have an impact? She's written half a dozen highly acclaimed novels and one nonfiction with The Kisses of His Mouth. The love affair with a soulmate comes to a sudden heartbreaking end. Can You Ever Love Again? And where does sex come into it? Curious, ask my guest. And without further ado, welcome Monique Groffy to Goldster Inside Story.
Hi, Humphrey. Gosh, I haven't done an event for a while, actually. I've been working on another book. So it's lovely to have such an enthusiastic reminder of who I must be, because I forget. I'm so busy writing, I can't remember what I've done.
Oh, my goodness. Then I'm going to ask you sometime during the show who your real person is and who your author persona is, because my first question to you, which comes out of A Mermaid and Black Conscience, what is a magical realist? Is that what you are, Monique?
I am a magical realist, and I don't think that's as easy an answer as you would like it to be. It's a term that was coined first in the art world in Europe. And it then spread to the Americas, where writers like Juan Rulfo and García Márquez and Isabel Allende were writing about somewhere between realism and surrealism. It sits magical realism. It's a place where the unlikely and the improbable are every day. And it's kind of controversial because things happen in the Caribbean that we see as not magic at all. But to a European coming to the Caribbean, and they see and encounter some of the things we think are very everyday, they seem like magic. So it's a European term for what we in the Caribbean think of as not really that magical, really. But yeah, it bends the rules a bit. A magical realist bends the rules between reality and surreality.
Okay, so that's I want to start the whole, we've got a big discussion with Mermaid of the Black Conch, which is set in the Caribbean and has got a lot of magic on it, because when I was reading it, I scrawled a note, and I want you to tell me if I'm completely right or completely wrong. I said, and it was fantastic prose, I said, this is where Shakespeare's Tempest meets Hemingway's Old Man and the Sea. Anywhere near accurate?
Very close. Shakespeare's Tempest meets Hemingway's Islands in the Stream.
Island in the Stream. Okay.
Yeah, there's a big catch scene in that book, Hemingway's Islands in the Stream.
Right.
I've referenced in the back of Mermaid, because okay, I knew nothing about how to catch a big fish until I read him, and he does know a lot about deep sea fishing. And so I did take some of what he was writing about, and obviously made it my own.
Oh, good.
Hemingway is out there, although I am anti big game fishing. So in a way, I'm writing back to Hemingway in a feminist way, if you could say, a feminist revision of Hemingway.
Okay, a feminist revision of Hemingway. I love that, and we're going to get onto the literature of that in a second. But firstly, the magical realism, the Caribbean, the things that happen that to Europeans are strange, set us the story and the scene of the mermaid and the back conch.
Set us the scene.
Yeah, set us the scene. Where is it? What's happening? How does it...
Okay, it's the 1970s. It's a small Caribbean island. And in the 70s in the Caribbean, we had a time of nation building, and some of the islands, especially the Anglophone islands, were newly independent. It was the 70s. It was an era of Black Power and Bob Marley and, you know, get up, stand up, and numerous firebrand Black Power leaders. It was Black radical politics. It was a really, really interesting time. Feminism, university, nation building, all of that. So, however, we are not setting, that is the kind of far-flung backdrop, the political backdrop to what's actually a very small, sleepy village on a very small island. And there is a small cast of characters. There is a white overseer landlady who owns everything. And we have a fishing competition that happens every year where fishermen from all over the Caribbean and the northern coast of South America, they gather to catch fish, big fish. They're going big fish game hunting. And so when we open, we have a fisherman, and we have a whole scenario where this fishing competition, people are gathering to try and catch something big. That's where we kind the book.
And you get, to my mind, you get very beautifully into the mind of your protagonist, the fisherman, and into what he thinks or discovers in the mermaid. So why did you put a mermaid character in there, and how does all that work?
Well, it's the mermaid story. So she is the lead. She's the main protagonist. And when I first started, so the book is told through three different points of view in a kind of patchwork montage. Mm-hmm. And so we have an omniscient narrator who knows everything and is telling everything in retrospect. And then we have David's entries, his diary, because he's also remembering what happened in the 70s. And then we have fragments of the mermaid and her voice, and you know, that she's penned, she did learn to speak and write English in a kind of creolized, non-standard English. And so we have the story unfolding. But ultimately, when I began writing, I just wanted to write in the mermaid's voice for, you know, 300 pages. And I realized, because it was not standard English, it was, I was writing in kind of verse, and it was so experimental that I probably would never find a reader if I was trying to write the whole book in such an experimental way. So she ended up getting small pieces of the book, but it's about her, it's her book. It's a retelling of an old Taino myth. Yeah. So I found the myth and I thought, oh, this is ripe for a rewrite.
You have a section that you're going to read to us a little bit from the beginning to sort of kind of set the scene. Could you give us that?
I could read you a little bit from when the fishermen see her for the first time.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the scene is there are fishermen, and they've all been two American men, and they have a local crew. They have a skipper and two men on board. So there's five men on board, and they know they've hooked something, but they don't know what it is. They think they've got a big fish. They know they've got something big, but they don't know what it is. So I'll read from when they first realise what they've caught. "The thing's about to come up," shouted the father. "Son of a goddamn bitch, it's coming up! Keep your rod up!" The flat dark sea broke open, and a mermaid rose up and out of the water, her hair flying like a nest of cables. Her arms flung backwards in the jump, her body glistening with scales, and her tail flailing huge and muscular, like that of a creature from the deepest part of the ocean. She beat up and out, arcing through the air, so she flipped on her back. And the men, they saw her head and her breasts and her belly and the pubic bone of a woman where it met the tail of a glistening fish. "Jesus Christ!" exclaimed Thomas Clayson, nice across himself. The Black Conch men gasped. "Cut the line," shouted Nicer Country. "Cut the goddamn line." All five men were horrified as she hit the water thrashing. Her mouth was bloody and she'd only just started to fight. On the end of Hank Clayson's rod was a wild creature, furious to be caught. Nicer knew they'd hooked something they shouldn't have. He jumped down from the flight bridge with his knife. The mermaid, or whoever it was, deserved to stay in the sea. This wasn't his business at all. The thing looked too big for the boat. It could take the boat down even. "Don't do that," shouted Thomas Clayson as Nicer bent to cut the line. "Do not do that. She is worth millions. Millions. We're bringing her in, goddammit. We are bringing her in." But she was on the surface now, thrashing like a Mako shark, fighting the line with her arms, coughing up blood and spitting and screaming in a high wailing song. "Oh God," stammered Hank. Did you see that?" His hands were shaking with the rod. The father wanted to take it from him. The Black Conch men, Nicholas and Shortleg, backed away from the stern. Like Nicer, they knew this was wrong. They afraid bad jumpy fish catch. They didn't want to help. They were lost for words for what to do. The white men wanted to pull this creature out of the sea, but this fish was half woman, plain enough. Everybody had heard of the mermen in Black Conch waters, but a merwoman? Nah. She carried with her bad luck at best, and her hair had frightened them, like she could kill with just one lash from those tentacles. She could poison them all. They'd seen spikes on her back, dorsal spikes, scorpion fish spikes. They had seen a bloody, raging woman on the end of a fishing line, and now these white men wanted to bring her in? Nah, boy, they all said to themselves. I'll just stop there. Goes on and on.
I could listen to that for the whole show. I have two questions that come out of that. Firstly, what is the origin of the merman myth?
That's an old story that comes, it's in Tobago, that the story is that these mermen can come onto land and mate with the local women. And that's an old colonial story. So it's just one of many, many, many Caribbean and, you know, mermaid stories around the world.
Oh, okay. And secondly, is that with your creative writing hat, when you sit down to write a scene as beautiful and vivid and as disciplined as that, can you give us just an idea of how you go about it? Is it nurture or is it nature? Do you learn it or are you just brilliant at it?
I have to say that I've been writing for a very long time now. So like most of my life, since I started taking myself seriously in my early 30s, and I'm now in my late 50s. So the good 20 plus years of my life I've been writing, and I hate to say this, but I've got better. I think people do get better at what they do the longer they do it and the more practice. So this book isn't as assured as my first novel. My first novel was an okay novel, but it's not what I'm capable of writing now. I did do an MA and a PhD in creative writing early on, and I teach at that level. So what I would say is that over time, I've learned to understand how to show and how to tell. And that we need to show more than we tell, but you can't do without either of them. They're both really important parts of making a narrative live on the page. And then when we think about dramatization and showing, we have to understand that there are different types. There are different things you can do as a creative writer to make something visible and have energy on the page. And with this catch scene, I wanted to write what I call a rolling scene, an epic scene, which would go over several pages. And so I had first seen this. I think the best way to learn how to write is to read lots of other writers. So one of the writers who showed me how to do this was Cormac McCarthy, actually.
Oh, okay.
Cormac McCarthy's a brilliant writer. He's incredibly agile, and he's a very visual writer. And in one of his books, I think it was Blood Meridian, he wrote this incredible story of Apaches attacking a train of pioneers or whatever they are, coming in a wagon train. And it's a rolling scene. It goes on and on. Mm-hmm. And I studied it and I use it a lot and I teach it. So I would storyboard a long scene. If I want something to have a lot of energy, it's a big writing exercise, and you want to be building, 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 building until the reader can barely bear it anymore. And then you cut, maybe take the tempo down. So it was a big, big structured storyboard scene, that catch scene, which goes over like several pages.
And how many times would you write it? Would you draft it, should we say, and edit it and re-edit it?
Well, sometimes I would say that when you first write something, a lot of great writing, like 80% of it, is good. I always think all novels need at least 3 drafts. Mm-hmm. And I would avoid over-tinkering. Over-tinkering is just another way to really, really hurt your work. Mm-hmm. So trust in a good first draft. And yeah, you do need to be drafting and chopping and chopping. I wrote a book in lockdown, a crime novel, and I did a draft. It was okay. And then I wrote another draft. I got feedback. I wrote another draft. It was much better. And then I left it for 2 years, and I'm now tinkering with it again. And I've got such a clear head with it now. I can chop, 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 chop. A lot of it has to come out. So time, this is not a quick process.
Yeah.
Developing objectivity. And I also have, even now, 20 years on, I have people I either ask to read, so peers who are happy to do a swap, or pay to read my books.
And I want to say to our audience, any questions, comments you've got about creative writing, we're getting a great little masterclass here at the moment, the Caribbean, climate change, mermaids, put it in the chat and Monique will do her best to answer it. And if she can't, she'll say she can't. But you mentioned rolling scene. What are the names of the other types of scenes that a reader can expect in a book?
That's a big question. There's a basic scene, which is action dialogue. One day usually starts with a cue. One day this happened, and then, we have dialogue and action. You can also compress a scene into exposition. That's a weird crossover scene. So it looks like exposition, but in that things can happen. So you can almost like reported speech. You can report a scene, and it can still have a lot of dialogue dynamism. There can be, I used to have all kinds of scenes in my workshop. Dialogue only. Sometimes dialogue is the purest form of showing. And so dialogue, you can do a lot with running dialogue. Sometimes I get my students just to have two characters arguing and arguing and throwing things at each other. That's a scene. So there's multiple ways of having dramatization on the page.
Okay, that is fantastic. And if anybody wants to know more about this, Monique does teach it. So you can go to the Port of Spain and go to one of her classes, or probably or to Manchester or something like that. I want to get moved to the Caribbean itself now, because you sort of set that scene there, and you've set, your writing weaves all of that in. The Caribbean islands punch above their weight, don't they, when it comes to great writers? I'm thinking V.S. Naipaul, Donna Hemmings, Jamaica Kincaid, and a whole lot of stories that come from there. Mm-hmm. And so what is it there that sort of brings this great creativity, literary creativity?
Well, it's very interesting, because we do punch above our weight, and we have 2 Nobel laureates. In fact, we have 3 Nobel laureates. And in Trinidad, we have great writers. And what's happened is that the great writers of the golden 50s and 60s and 70s have been replaced by a massive uprising in mostly women writing across all kinds of backgrounds. So Muslim, Hindu, I'm a Buddhist, European, you know, African, Indian. It's such a big polyglot. And so we've got writers, you know, in Barbados and Jamaica, in the islands, in diaspora. The internet has really helped open things up and democratize things and make it possible for writers in the region to enter competitions, get known, find agents. But also there've been an amazing things on the internet. So writers in the Caribbean are using Substack, they're blogging, they're using social media, they're setting up book groups. So Caribbean writers are like, we will never be forgotten. You know, we are here, we are here, we are here. Not just writers, but readers. So we have incredible book groups.
Why is there
so much talent?
Yeah.
It has something to do with the polyglot mashup of race and faith and atrocity. An atrocity that has never been repaired. So reparations have never been made to the indigenous people, to the enslaved Africans and the indentured Indians. There is a whole heap of trauma. There's layers and layers and layers and layers and layers of stuff. And there's and pirating and colonialism and extraction and trafficking. There's such a massive, there is enough going on in the Caribbean, both currently and historically, for everybody to be writing a lot. We don't have a problem. I mean, I was on the stage at Charleston last autumn with an Indo-Caribbean writer, an Afro-Caribbean writer, and myself. We all come from Trinidad. Mm. And there's plenty going on in Trinidad for us all to base our books there and not be stepping on each other's toes.
Can you ground us in your own background now that you've given us that, your childhood and your growing up and your thought process and realizations as you grew up?
Sure. My parents came in 1956, so about 70 years ago now, and they arrived as young people with apparently, and I find this incredible, but they arrived by boat with two suitcases and a bicycle. My mother brought her green bicycle to Trinidad because she was a keen cyclist, and it was a rally bike with a sit-up-and-beg rally bike with a basket.
Yeah.
And nobody really rides around anywhere in Trinidad on a bike. You know, it's just not done.
Yes.
Just one of those rules that people know and don't break.
Yes.
So she was European. My mother spoke many languages. My father was very much an old British colonial. He got himself a basic clerk job, a low, you know, he was 25. They were young. They were young people.
Okay. Yeah.
And so my dad came as a sort of office clerk.
Yeah.
For a 4-year contract because he thought, yahoo, Trinidad, you know. And my mum came with him and they had a 4-year contract and they're still there. So dad loved cricket. He loved the sun. He did well in the company. And he bought himself enough land to build a house and they stayed. And so we're all born in Trinidad.
So you're European Trinidadian as opposed to Caribbean Trinidadian.
White Creole Trinidad, Creolized.
So what do you see yourself? How do you see yourself in the world?
You know, Humphrey, it would be so nice to say I'm English or I'm British. I'm half English or I'm European. And in some ways, I live here mostly now and my parents are English European.
Uh-huh.
But because we've spent 70 years in the Caribbean and we've, like, you know, my grandmother and my father and my mother lost a child, they're all buried there and my brothers had children there and I've been to school there and I've gone backwards and forwards all my life. The Caribbean plays an enormous part culturally in my awareness of how things work, power structure and coloniality, of course, coloniality. Because my parents came out.
They were colonials, yes.
And they could come to a Caribbean island that was still presided over politically by colonizing forces, British. And they came as part of that era. and they settled and they stayed. So I feel as though I'm not naive. I'm very aware of what that all means. Yeah.
I want to talk. We've got an interesting note from Gillian James here. Quite a long one, but it's so fascinating. I'm going to mention it and let us know if it has any resonance with you. The Trinidadian author Sir V.S. Naipaul wrote two books, which included my mother as Helen and the Mimic Men, and about christening of my brother in the first 20 pages or so of The Enigma of Arrival, a book that I've read, where her character is based on Angela. She knew him when he came to London when he was 17, and she was running a boarding house in Earl's Court. She's also mentioned in his biography, whereas she is said to be from Italy, but she was actually from Malta, but spent the war years in Italy. You're familiar with The Enigma of Arrival? And
oh, God, I have to admit, I haven't read them for years. And I'm not a big fan of Naipaul for various reasons.
Right.
I've read some of his work, not all of his work, and I have my own problems with Naipaul.
Oh, tell us those.
Well, first of all, what's the person's question? Has she got a question?
No, it's not. It was just a comment. It was
amazing.
It's a comment, and I just thought, you know, there could be but it's got us onto Naipaul because I think he's, you know, among the most prominent
it's very difficult for me as a writer and a woman, because one of the things that Naipaul said, and he didn't say it, like he said it when he was still, you know, not that in 2011 he said this, was that women can't write, and that they're not as good as men, and they're too sentimental, and we're not masters of our own destiny or our own house or our. I mean, he didn't say that when, you know, in the 60s, you know, when it may have been true that women were still in some way lacked being liberated. But I mean, so his misogyny towards women for me is a problem. And the few books I've read, you know, you can see it not just in Naipaul's work, but in many men, i.e. Hemingway and many others,
yes,
who write in a really pejorative way about women, and also don't give women agency and power as a protagonist. Don't think women through. They were writing abreast of a time in the 60s where women weren't in the same way they're emancipated today, or maybe my generation is, certainly the generations coming under me. But also, you know, he did admit that he beat his lover and
disrespected
his wife. You can't put that aside, because it does come out in his work. It is who he is. He was extremely patronizing to young writers in the region, and particularly somebody called Kevin Jared Hussein, whose big book is coming out currently with Bloomsbury called Hungry Ghosts. And Kevin is like a young Hindu Indian writer who went to see, this is just one story about Naipaul. He went to see Naipaul at the University of the West Indies give a talk, and Naipaul was incredibly disparaging to him and said, don't bother writing, you know, just don't bother. Yeah. So he is revered by some people in the Caribbean and in Trinidad, definitely not by me. He comes from an era where men could be openly disdainful and disparaging and scornful, misogynistic, mm-hmm, to women and to women who write. And it does show up in some of the things he writes. In Gorillas, for example, in Gorillas, for example, yeah, it is a book loosely based on the Michael X killings and Gail Benson, who was horribly, brutally killed and buried while she was still alive. And there is a rape scene in that, an anal rape scene, which, you know, why would that, how would he know? Why would that need to go in? I wouldn't write such a scene. It's not, you know, why, you know, who's what? And also it begs the question, why didn't anyone question it or stop it? So these men, they all used to hate each other, Wolcott, Naipaul. They would criticize each other and throw punches. And for me, it's not modern. It's not what we would do these days. We all understand. I think there's a code of conduct amongst writers. We know that writers live on about £7,000 a year. So there's lots to say about that generation. It was all male. And I don't respect this kind of extraneous, let's read their books, fine, but there was all of that that went with it. which felt incredibly alienating and intimidating.
That begs a tangential question, if I may. Is there so much now about these sensitivity editors, about changing, you know, books to make them, to republish them, make them of their time? Mm. Are you of the view that, you know, the writing or some of the words or terminology of people like V.S. Naipaul, Ernest Hemingway, that should be changed, or should they just be left?
I don't think they should be changed. I think they should be studied, though, in context.
Okay.
I don't think we've got enough paper on the planet Earth to be re-establishing books in which white men said derogatory things about women and people of colour. There are hundreds of these books where white men, you just read, God knows, I mean... I teach the late 20th century novel. I used to teach at Manchester Met. Yes. And it had to weed out. I mean, we would find it hard to find a male writer who wasn't saying disparaging things about people of colour and about women. It's rife. So do I think this should all be rewritten? No, I think we should be studying it. It already is being studied, you know, feminist... Yeah. Women's studies, post-colonial studies, it's already being studied. We know about this. So move on, you know, is my feeling.
Okay. Anybody got any views on that? Because that's a fascinating topic that we're on to. Put it into the chat and we'll divert our whole
show. There's too much of it for it to be rewritten.
Gillian James, who brought us into Naipaul, my mother was not very happy about what and how he wrote about her. She did say he was not a very nice character.
Yeah,
so at least we have some corroboration there. Tell us about the colonial element there. It's coming out more and more, isn't it? Because is it Barbados has said they don't want the royal family anymore?
Yeah.
The Guardian is running a big piece about reparations of slavery and that. Encapsulate that for us.
Well, also, King Charles has just said, oh, we'll look into it, hasn't he?
Yes.
I thoroughly believe that if it hadn't been for the internet, if the internet had not been invented whenever it was, and if we didn't have social media, I think that because the politics in Europe, well, in parts of Europe and certainly in this country, is dominated by a right-wing elite. And this right-wing elite are the people who are close to the Queen, and who are responsible for sending people, young people to war, young men to war from a different class. I really think that we wouldn't be talking about reparations because generations would have gone by. It would have been like a lying dogs lie, you know.
Yes.
I really think that what these atrocities have happened so many times, 500 years of the English Empire, the Europeans. I mean, I can't even begin to, don't even know where to start talking about all of this. Europe is 8% of the world's landmass, and they have colonized something like 90%. Hmm. This is a very hard Pandora's box. This is very hard to put back in the box.
Mm-hmm.
However, and I think also, again, without the internet, where would the will of the people be? Where would the internet has given everyday people a voice and democratized our voices?
Yes.
So people are holding governments to power, and people have power they never used to have. This whole thing could have been glossed. Colonialism could have been.
But now that it's out,
but we have
there.
The internet. Hang on a minute. So yeah. There is. This is a past that. It's not all our problems today, but if you think about climate change and its extraction and capitalism and white supremacy, all these systems are an interweave. They're an interweave that have become unsustainable and very wounding to the psyche. And we do have the North dominating and extracting from the South. Not just, I mean, hence coloniality, you know, the people in the North just thought they could sail south and do what they liked.
And conquer and enslave.
Enslave, conquer
and make money.
Make money.
Yes. But so now that it's coming out, now that it's coming out, Monique, and in the, you know, we're sort of still in the Caribbean, which has been highly colonized and all the
it's
rest.
There's only one region of the world that's been.
Just one region of the world. But since you're familiar with it, what is the sort of everyday talk about this as it comes out? As Barbados says, you know, we don't want the royal family anymore, as sort of more slave atrocities come out. You talk about those atrocities as the reasons to
run. Newspaper. Are having to face that the founders have contracted slavery.
I mean, what is the sort of the streets of Trinidad, for example? Is this a conversation? Is it something that everybody brings up? Or
I mean, it's not just look at Meghan Markle, how she was treated. I mean, what was the royal family thinking of treating her so badly? Yes, it is a conversation, but of course, it depends who you're, as we call, liming with, who you're hanging out with. Yeah. So in my case, I hang out with other writers, probably people who read, probably people who are in academia. So I don't necessarily hang out with people in rum shops on the street. But what I would say is amongst people who I know, it is a hot conversation. It's a hot topic of conversation.
Hot topic, is it?
And it's also what our canon, both our canons, are engaged with this idea of, like, you know, extraction and dominance and what it's left behind in its wake. Mm-hmm. And but you can also feel a palpable rage. I mean, people always say, oh, you're going to Trinidad, it's so lovely. Oh, how lovely, it's so hot. Oh, you know, have a lovely holiday. And I'm like, what are you, Trinidad's a really tough place. When I was there at Christmas, a good friend of mine was murdered. You know, people die, people are murdered, people kill. There's 500 murders a year. It's one of those places like Colombia where it makes the top 10 of where the worst homicides are, because we have totally lost control of all sorts of problems, drug problems. There's no policing, corruption. And so people are, it's just a terrible place. I find it hard to drive around at night.
Yeah.
On my own these days. So
I think Annie is agreeing with you, totally agree we should not rewrite them. This is our previous conversation, and let people learn about these misogynistic men. And while I'm about it, colonialism should be taught in schools.
I agree with that. Yeah.
When I was at school, a huge pink map of the British colonies, essentially, but it was telling what a wonderful life we gave to all those people, and that is now coming out as nobby. Yeah, you seem angry might be too much of a word, but you do seem very sort of.
I do because also I have pale skin, so you get caught up in these things, and I think because you know I am interested in writing in a critical way, and I am part of the canon. But I think it is an absolute, well, the crime is coloniality itself, but compounded by the fact that the colonizing countries, and the worst by far are the Spanish, because they took the whole of North and South America.
Yes.
As well as parts of the Indies. Columbus, you know, came from, Queen Isabella sent Columbus. So I think not teaching what really happened to our children and young people is a big crime as well.
But should we be angry about it? Should we teach it and absorb it and accept it? Or yes, should we go for reparations?
Reparations are needed. God, no, I couldn't even begin to say how and what, because it's a massive outpay.
Yeah.
But I went to Berlin not that long ago, and I went to a festival there, and I spent the day, I was given a guide, a young, you know, all the writers who come in are given a guide, you know, for the day, and the guide will take us here, there and everywhere. And she was about 21, and I said I wanted to go to the Holocaust Museum, and she said that young people in Germany are really, really, really taught about what happened under the Nazis.
Yes.
And because they never want it to happen again. Yeah. And it's very shaming. It's very difficult. And we need the same kind of education program.
Did you go to school in Trinidad as a little girl?
Some in Trinidad, but mostly here.
And in Trinidad and here during that time, were you taught about what you're telling us now?
No.
Nor was I. Jill asked, what does Monique think about retrospective apologies?
Oh, yes, I would say. I think they're coming, aren't they? I think they're happy with apologies.
Yeah.
I think there needs to be, because this, I think the powers that be, i.e. the European elites, the right wing, who are connected to the aristocracies, wanted to just push this all under the carpet and everybody to get over it and move on.
Yes.
And I think that collectively, these European colonizing countries need to have a really good think about what can be done and said. In terms of establishing education, what kind of reparations can be said, what kind of public apologies can be said, and in what way they can plow funds back in.
Yeah.
Because what they did was just like retreat after the Second World War. It's like, oops, we can't afford, you're not producing enough sugar anymore. They all retreat here, you can have your independence.
Retreat or deny. And I get quite angry myself because we're still doing it with Afghanistan and Iraq. We still think we've got God's given.
I don't know who the hell we think we are. Yeah.
And Annie is also angry. Annie says, I'm angry and I'm British, but I've always questioned, why are these people different to us? We're all the same people. Just so ignorant about other countries. They need educating.
We do. I mean, I think it's a class thing. And I think this Tory party, as we can all see, they are really, really not able to survive something as simple as social media. Yeah. They can't handle it. I mean, just look at what social media has done, which has democratized satire, power, voting, influence.
Yes.
And given it to the people. I mean, I just give you one example. So that Liz Truss, who was a disaster, I don't know if anybody remembers. Yes, XR. Have we got any XR people here, by the way?
In fact, Patrick just asked a question about it. So why don't we get onto that right now?
Give you an example of why I think things are changing and that the Tories are going to be decimated at the next election and they will never come back. I think they're going to be down to about 40 MPs and that will be it.
Oh my goodness.
That will be it because they can't survive what's happening, modernity. Just think about Liz Truss, when we had that meme on social media, who's more popular, Liz Truss or a lettuce? Okay, and that's the lettuce won.
Yes, who's going to last longer, wasn't it?
Liz and so the Tories, they're not used to this level of being undermined.
Yeah.
Because that kind of a meme gets seen millions of times.
Yeah.
And before we know it, nobody wants a lettuce in the heading party. the Tories can't cope with this. They can't cope.
And Patrick has skillfully dovetailed us to your other role as the literary voice of climate change. Extinction Rebellion, he asks, seems to be disruptive rather than effective so far. Writers Rebel having more success in combating climate change? What is Writers Rebel? Are you having more success, Monique?
We have managed to insert a cohort of people who are typically introverted, work alone, don't like joining groups, and yet they say they're engaged. They're engaged with politics and, you know, life, meaning, philosophy. So I think we have galvanized and activated a very hard to activate group of people. And we have given numerous types of platforms. So we have podcasts like this, we have a blog, we have a newsletter, we have live open air events, we go on marches. So over the last, it's 4 years now we've been going, we've managed to get the most quiet, shy, mild-mannered, not a joiner, don't like sticking my head above the parapet, I'm scared to say anything in case people will mock me online. We've managed to generate momentum behind this movement. But I also see that you're saying, have XR been effective at all? Yes. They have trained up. We haven't really seen a movement like this since the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s in America. And they had strategists. They had somebody called James Lawson, And they had strategists that understood that they needed to train people in NVDA, which is nonviolent direct action. And they had to activate what Gandhi had, which was a type of satyagraha. That's what he called his marches, mm-hmm. nonviolence. So XR has basically learned from Gandhi, from James Lawson, and from a man called Gene Sharp. And they've understood that it's very, very, very hard for the state and the police, or anybody policing the state, for the state, to lock up or have an old woman who is peaceful, but she just happens to be sitting in the road, or an old man. I have been out on these streets many times now in the last few years. I have seen elderly people, okay, sitting down on the street.
Is it effective?
And this is really hard. This is where a turning point happens, where, and in court, the vicar, Reverend Sue Parfitt recently, who's going to lock her up? Okay, she's a vicar and she's in her 70s. Who's going to lock her up? Really? Send her to prison? No. And she's breaking the law, but she's breaking it very politely. And these people are getting, the judges and the lawyers now have all bandied together and said, we're not going to lock any more of these people up.
But what do you have to do to change or to combat climate change? Patrick's question, is it effective?
Okay. So we have to critical mass. So the ISO, the Institute of Data, data gathering, you know who I mean, 74% of the people in this country are very concerned about the climate. 74%. That's a massive, massive percentage. Only about under 1% are doing what I'm doing, which is being disruptive. In fact, I haven't been that disruptive. I haven't been arrested. Many of my friends have, but I have never locked myself onto anything or stuck myself or blocked anyone's daily work.
Word yourself. And
but a lot of that is happening. And a lot of that is saying that what the problem we have that is coming down the line within a decade is much bigger than you, sir, not being able to get to work today, or that they'll be blocking the roads or the traffic. And they do let ambulances through, of course they do, but they are basically out arguing the status quo. They're out arguing with moral authority that.
But given the other groups there are, and all the COPT conferences and everything like that, are you able to? I think my question is: can an author, can a great book or a great piece of writing actually punch through and
they
do what is necessary?
The Ministry. What's that guy's name? The Ministry of. There have been amazing books recently. There's a book that everybody is talking. Well, have you probably read The Overstory?
Yes.
But there's the Ministry of,
Whilst you're looking at that, Emma is asking, can you tell us your vision of what effects climate change will have by 2030? So we'll...
The Ministry for the Future.
Okay,
It's set in India, where millions are dying of deadly heat. Ministry of the Future by, Kim Stanley Robinson.
Okay.
That's a book that has gone viral and is I don't need to write the great climate change novel because it's being written. People are writing these books now.
Yeah. When we talked earlier, you gave this very sort of graphic description of how the system works and what you have to break through in order to get to really combat climate change, people's habits, the way they eat, obviously the way we do, but also governments have to change, don't they?
Unfortunately, what's... Okay, so here's what I think. I think Extinction Rebellion have done a lot to raise awareness, like Greenpeace has never done, even though I respect Greenpeace. So what Greenpeace do is they say, you pay me 20 quid a month and we'll do it for you. And then the person who's paying their subscription to Greenpeace gets their conscience appeased. They don't do any activism and they hand over the activism to Greenpeace. Whereas what XR did is they decentralized. They said, this is what we stand for. You can do it yourselves. Go away, set up a group. And hundreds of groups. And 4 years later, they activated hundreds and thousands of people. It's gone global. So with that, if the average person who's not active but concerned now has an awareness. So that 70% of the people who are concerned, I think, would they have been so concerned if it hadn't been for all the pink boats arriving in the middle of Oxford Circus and people abseiling down Big Ben and doing these incredible things. But I think so there's a new awareness, and sadly, what is coming are food shortages, which we already have. You know, they didn't have tomatoes in the shops in March, you know, didn't have peppers or tomatoes. I mean, that's just the beginning of what we're going to be facing.
So it's sort of punching the message out there. What do you eat, Monique?
I am not a vegan, but I have radically changed my eating habits. So I tend to only buy organic fruit and veg. And you can get organic fruit and veg delivered in a box. You can try Oddbox or one of these, Riverside or Abel and Cole. And I try to finish that box. It's only £15. You know, that's a good veg box. And I also only really eat chicken and fish these days. And again, organic.
It's just to sort of encapsulate as individuals, if we've got to stop eating beef because of the methane from cows, stop driving cars because of that, stop flying. Anything else?
The flying, you don't have to stop because it will become so expensive that there'll be a huge drop off.
Right.
So the stopping flying, I would say, give that 5 years.
In 5 years, just nobody. So this is Emma's.
I think it's no longer. And I think younger generations, young people coming up, will find it uncool. It won't be cool to go on a gap year. It'll be like, really? You're going to go flying around the world? It won't be. There'll be a generation of young people who wouldn't consider it to get around the world ticket. Or what people will be doing will be interrailing more, going across Europe, working at home. We've got young people. A young woman has just joined Writers Rebel, and she was saying that young people, her generation, are growing up with trauma because they know that things are going to be tough for them. Okay. But I think what you and I are of a different generation. Imagine you're 18.
Yes.
And you have joined XR, or you're very aware of XR, or your family are. Are you going to go and buy a round the world ticket to go on your gap year, or go to Thailand on a?
No, you could bicycle around the world, couldn't you? And that would be all right. But I think Jenna's got a comment here. Interesting that in the Climb book, Greta Thunberg doesn't say in the "What can you do as an individual" that we should recycle. She says that as a "do it if you want," but it's not going to change anything. She says that we should become activists, become politically active, talk about it, and that we should also become plant-based with our diet.
Yeah,
You agree with all of that, do you?
I think the big problem is fossil fuel extraction.
And weaning ourselves off the fossil fuels. And also there's the big countries like India and China and the developing nations that are saying, you know, why should we not develop? And
they need to be supported, just like the CFC3s that we all were frightened of in the 90s or the 80s. It was all in fridges. All those gases were in fridges, and it was affecting the ozone. And then I think India said, well, how do you think we're going to do it? You know, and they were supported. And guess what? The ozone layer is healing. You know, it's closing.
And very quickly, Annie says, this government doesn't want to know. I think you and Annie are as one in this show. There is an enormous demonstration coming up in London soon. I urge everyone to go that can. You'll meet some incredible people and hold the government to account. Will you be there, Monique?
Yes, Writers Rebel are going to be outside 55 Tufton Street from 12 till 2 on Friday, next Friday, the 21st. Please bring a placard and a poem. We're asking people to bring poems. We're going to stick them on the pillars or stick them to Tufton Street somehow, which isn't criminal damage because we're just using sticky tape. And Yeah, turn up, come and see us. We'd love you to come and support us.
If you want to meet Monique, that's where to be. Just wait there for a moment. I'm going to talk to you for a few seconds about your nonfiction book with the kisses of his mouth. But first, I'm going to tell people what is coming up next. Tomorrow, Lucinda is with Alexis Keir, who has a new book, Windward Family, An Atlas of Love, Loss and Belonging, explores the lives of people who have traveled over several generations from the Caribbean island of St. Vincent to England. Do you know Alexis?
No.
So this is, we seem to be having a Caribbean week this week. April the 20th, at a different time, 6 p.m. in the evening, I'm with Danielle Sibluski, who's been making the Middle Ages fun and entertaining and accessible for over a decade. Her latest book is How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life. She tells us how medieval monastic practices, with their emphasis on healthy mind, soul, and body, can inspire us to lead more settled and fuller lives. And that's at 6 p.m. in the evening, not noon. Not quite sure why, but that is what it is. April 21st, the day of your protest, alas, but we can go from there, live at Riverstone and also virtual. Goldster, I'm back with Jane Thin, the author of Widowland and Queen High, among the most critically acclaimed novels of recent years. This is coming up with the coronation, an alternate history where instead of Nazi defeat, there's been a grand alliance between Great Britain and Germany. Queen High is Queen Wallis Simpson. If you want to go to that, just email concierge@goldster.co.uk and a ticket will be arranged. John Hans was originally going to be on April 21st slot with his fascinating Future of Humankind, and that is now going to be on June the 9th. And then April 27th, I'm with Peter Popham and his boundary-breaking novel India Be Damned, a novel of partition, another colonial mishap, atrocities, a brilliant fictional account of India's violent independence. And April 28th, by a hair's breadth of a popular vote, book of the month is Franz Kafka's Metamorphoses, the salesman who one day wakes up to become a cockroach and has to work out how his family deals with that and what that sort of thing means for us all. Do you know Metamorphoses, Monique?
I do, yeah.
Do you like it?
Yeah. Kafka. Yeah, it's the ultimate magical realism. Magical real, isn't it?
In the couple of minutes we've got left, you did a sort of heart-wrenching non-fiction book about losing a soulmate recovering from that. Tell us about that.
Well, you just summed it up perfectly. It's a book about losing my soulmate and who's still alive and just, and we're still friends, just. And he's a fellow writer. So I had a relationship in my 30s, which seemed to last a long time. We lived together and we ran a writing school together. And it was complicated between us. Intimately, it was complicated. I was young, didn't really know how to change the situation. And in the end, the relationship didn't survive. Even though he was my soulmate, I adored this person and love him to this day. And then I went on a big quest of sexual self-discovery and I reported back and I lived to tell the tale and I published under my own name. And what I feel most proud of is not only that I did write the book, but I survived the book. There was a big, very shaming review in the Sunday Times, which almost took me down at one point. But I feel when I'm older, because novels are here or there, people enjoy novels. But if you write a good memoir and you set out to sort of like go, God, you know, guess what I've done? You know, you might like this too. It's the book I get the best response from readers. You know,
when you say shaming, how did it shame? How and why did it shame you? And how did you?
The whole sort of, oh, really, Monique, you know, get a life, Monique. Your husband was, you know, your partner was ugly. The tantra teachers were awful. Oh, get a life. Oh, stop whinging. Oh God, you know, I mean, just missed the point of where I was going and trying to go, and made me feel, tried to make me feel, ashamed in some way, for loving him so much, you know, and for not getting over him quickly enough.
You still love him?
Yeah.
Which brings us on to the last thought that we've got you, because Goldster is for a sort of we're looking to a 50 plus demographic of people who are going about changes in their lives, what we might call a life quake of change, which seems to be what you had there. Give us a tip. Give us a one liner that if something inexplicably dreadful happens, can be anything. How do you pick yourself up and press on?
Get lots of help. I've done everything. I've done everything, you know. I've done loads and loads of psychoanalysis, loads of different types of therapy. I'm a Buddhist. I meditate. I work out. I've got a personal trainer. I definitely do everything I can to support my mental health.
Yeah.
I'm on my own. I'm a single woman, but I don't know if I would have survived getting from 35 to 55 without calling in lots and lots of help. And also, some of this wasn't that expensive. You know, I lived in the realm of personal growth for most of my 40s in the aftermath of a big breakup.
Get lots of help. Don't be ashamed or worried about getting help. Very interesting. Going to look for her books. That's it.
That it.
Time's Wing Chariot is flying in from magical islands and it's arrived.
I get to say one more thing.
Yes, yes.
I'd also say you just don't know what's going on in other people's lives and minds. And my big tip would be never try to second guess, never worry about what other people, the people that have hurt you or you think don't like you, you just don't know. You just don't know. I think if I could look back and tell my, never worry about what other people think, because you don't know what they think, so you haven't got a clue. Never try and second guess. Anyway,
that is great. We're getting brilliant. Thank you, says Jill. Thank you, Monique. Engaging, says Emma. Whole lot of emojis, which I haven't yet worked out to do on my WhatsApp and that. They're all wonderful. So that is it. You have given us a wonderful insight. We have gone from climate change to Caribbean to creative writing in just an hour, a colourful tapestry. Thank you. Thank you to our great audience for all your contributions and challenges.
Thank you, Humphrey. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. It's been great. And email concierge@goldster.co.uk if you want to make our Riverstone event, and then you can go from there to see Monique at Tufton Street with her protest.
12 till 2, Friday the 21st.
12 to 2. We finish at 1. So
lots of great writers coming. Zadie Smith, you know, God knows. Rupert Reed, Rosie Boycott, various big names coming
fantastic.
Down.
Fantastic.
So, and also writers with no profile whatsoever. We've got a bunch of really interesting people coming down.
Brilliant minds, brilliant protests, and a brilliant show we're going to have with Jane Thin at Riverstone. And then until tomorrow, Alexis Weir. That's it. Stay curious, keep asking, stay involved, stay active, stay safe, and of course, stay Goldster. And goodbye, Monique Roffey. What a brilliant guest you have been. And bye, everybody. Thank you for listening. And find out our vast range on www.goldster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Goldster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Goldster.